to wake you up when you did not wake up at your normal time.
Cindy snickered and shook her head.
I am truly very sorry, madame, Nanny continued, looking pleadingly into Cindy's eyes. I did not mean to find out anything.
Cindy stirred her coffee with a silver spoon and set it down. The ocean breeze, which Nanny had enjoyed that morning, was no longer relaxing. It'd become a nuisance as it gained force and blew her braids into her face. Deliberately, Cindy took off her sunglasses, put them on the table, and looked into Nanny's eyes.
You probably look at me, she said, and think I came from a life like this. You probably think I was born into this kind of money, right?
Nanny did not respond.
Well, I wasn't, Cindy went on. I came from a poor family.
A very, very poor family.
Me too, madame.
Cindy shook her head.
No, you don't understand, she said. Being poor for you in Africa is fine. Most of you are poor over there. The shame of it, it's not as bad for you.
Nanny closed her eyes and nodded as if she completely understood and agreed.
Over here, it's embarrassing, humiliating, very painful,
Cindy continued, looking into the distance beyond the trees.
Waiting in lines with homeless people to enter food pantries, living in a poorly heated house in the winter, eating rice and spam for almost every dinner, being laughed at in school, having people treat you as if you're some sort of...
A lone tear dropped down her right cheek. She brushed it off with her index finger.
You have no idea how much I've endured.
No, madame.
I won't ever forget the night I told my mother I wanted shrimp and vegetables for dinner. Such a luxury. How dare I ask for it? She slapped me
and sent me to bed hungry.
That was her thing. A slap or a reminder that I was just a piece of shit.
She cleared her throat. Nanny looked down at her hands, then Cindy's face.
But I came away from all that, as you can see. I worked my way through college, got a job, my own apartment, learned how to carry myself well and fit effortlessly in this new world, so I would never be looked down on again or seen as a piece of shit. Because I know what I am, and no one can ever take away the things I've achieved for myself.
It's true, madame.
Cindy picked up her teaspoon, stirred her coffee again. She put down the teaspoon and looked at Nanny, whose eyes were now lowered.
Why am I telling you all this, Nanny?
She asked.
I don't know, madame.
Nanny replied, her voice low and loaded with fright.
I'm telling you this because I want you to know where I came from and why I fight hard every day to remain here. To keep my family together. To have all this.
She spread her arm and motioned toward the house and the pool and the yard.
I'm telling you this, she said, her eyes fixed on Nanny's face. Because I want you to never tell anyone what happened yesterday. I swear to you, madame, on my grandmother's grave that I will never tell anyone. You are a woman, Nanny. A wife, a mother, like me. I am asking you to make this promise to me, not as from an employee to an employer, but as from one woman to another, as from one who knows how important it is to protect our families. I swear to you, madame, I promise you from one woman to another.
Cindy laid open her right hand on the table, and Nanny put hers in it.
Thank you,
Cindy said, smiling her first smile of the day and squeezing Nanny's hand. Nanny smiled back.
You're a good woman.
Nanny bowed her head and nodded. Cindy released her hand. Nanny stood up and began walking back to the kitchen.
By the way,
Cindy said,
what size clothes do you wear? When you're not pregnant, that is.
Nanny took a few steps back toward Cindy.
Size 6, madame, she replied.
That's bigger than me, Cindy said, the smile still on her face. But I think you can make do. I have a few things I was going to send over to the thrift store.
Oh, madame, yes, thank you. I'll take it. I know how to alter clothes. Thank you.
They're real designer goods, Cindy said, crossing her legs and picking up her iPhone. Dresses and stuff. I'm not sure if it's your style, but you can have it all.
Thank you, madame. I'll take it all. I'll make it my style. Thank you so much.
I'll have some things for your son, too. Mighty's old clothes and toys. You can take it all when you leave.
Oh, madame, I'm so glad. I don't even know how to thank you.
And remind me of your bonus before you leave. You'll need some extra money to prepare for the baby.
We will, madame. I will,
Nanny sang, placing her hand on her chest, then over her belly.
Thank you so much, madame. I am just so grateful.
Cindy looked at the gleeful woman and smiled again. Then he smiled back at her. They had found a win-win solution. Chapter 20 Leomi sat next to him in the passenger seat, sliding to the floor whenever a police car came in sight. When a white woman pointed out one morning that it was illegal for a child of Leomi's age to sit in the front seat of a car, Jende graciously replied that yes, it was. He knew. Thank you so much, madame. Father and son went to sleep together every night in their bedroom facing a funeral parlor, sometimes to the sounds of curses and scuffles among the grieving. They woke up in the morning with their bodies covered in sweat, the weak fan having brought little relief from the midsummer heat. After bathing, they ate fried ripe plantains and eggs, Jende always forcing Leomi to eat at least a whole plantain and two eggs and drink a full glass of orange juice. They dressed for the day together, donning jeans and t-shirts, Leomi always making sure he wore the same colors as his father. Their bellies full and lunch bags packed, they walked to the subway station hand in hand and took an uptown subway to pick up the cab in the Bronx. In the subway, they sat close to each other, Leomi's hand always in Jende's. After 4 hours of picking up and dropping off passengers, they took out their lunch, food Nanny had cooked and frozen, and ate in the back seat of the car. For dinners, they went every other day to one of the African restaurants on 116th Street, where they ordered acheque with grilled lamb, their favorite meal in all the restaurants there. Sometimes, after they were done eating, they bought ice cream at a shop on 115th Street and walked down Malcolm X Boulevard, holding hands and licking ice cream. The days were perfect for Jende, almost heavenly. And even though he missed his wife, he was happy to be alone with his son.
Papa?
Leomi said to him as they dined at a restaurant adjacent to the 116th Street subway one evening. Eh?
Is it true that we're going back to Cameroon?
Jende stopped chewing. He put down the ball of acheque he had in his right hand.
Who told you we are going back to Cameroon? He said, keeping his voice low so as not to pull attention, but widening his eyes to show Leomi how much he had aroused his anger.
No one, Papa,
Leomi replied, averting his eyes.
Then why are you asking me?
Nothing, Papa,
he replied.
I only heard Mama saying it on the phone.
Mama said it, eh? To who?
I don't know, Papa.
When did she say it?
Papa, I don't...
You don't what? Why were you listening to your mother's conversation?
The boy went mute, his small mouth covered with the white granules of acheque. Beside them, the bald man eating tiebujin had paused eating to watch the father, fists clenched on the table, and 7-year-old boy who appeared ready to run in terror.
We are not going back to Cameroon. You hear me?
Yes, Papa.
You are never going back to Cameroon. Do you hear me?
I hear you, Papa.
Finish your food.
Back at the apartment, Jende called Nanny
and without asking questions, mercilessly scolded her for exposing Leomi to their plan.
How dare you mention it in front of him?
I didn't know he was listening.
You don't need to know anything, Nenny. You don't have to know who is listening to what you are saying. You only need to learn how to shut your mouth sometimes.
But what if he knows? If the immigration judge decides to send us back home, are we going to shut his eyes so he doesn't know we are taking him back to Cameroon?
Jende slapped the frame of the bed and stood up, unable to believe his wife's words.
Nenny, he shouted. Is that what you think? You think we should tell a child his father might be deported? You want Leomi to know what's happening to me?
Nenny did not respond. It was the first time he had screamed at her so loudly. The first time in almost 20 years, from when they were teenagers at National Comprehensive.
Boubacar has promised us that we will be here for years, even if things don't end up the way we want them to. You know that. You know we still have many years in this country. Don't you know that?
I know what he said.
Then why are you going around talking as if we are leaving next month?
No one knows the future. Anything can happen. You know that.
Jende sat down and closed his eyes, shaking his head. For a moment he didn't know what to say to his wife.
Are you saying this because you think I'll be deported?
He said. His voice was low and woeful, saturated with anguish.
Nenny? Is that why you are talking to me like this?
No, bebe, please,
Nenny said. Embarrassment at the misery she was mindlessly causing him suddenly obvious in her voice.
That's not what I'm saying.
Then what are you saying?
I'm not saying anything, bebe. I'm sorry. I don't even know what I was trying to say.
Why are you making me feel so bad?
I'm really sorry, bebe. You know what is best for us. I won't talk about it when Leomi is home anymore.
Just stop talking about it. There's nothing to talk about. I'll get a green card.
You will, bebe.
Nenny responded, her voice cracking.
It's just that I'm so afraid sometimes. And I want to talk about it with my sister. I don't want to go back to Limbe, bebe. I don't even want to imagine what is going to happen if...
I'm afraid too, Nenny. You think I'm not afraid? But what has fear ever done for anyone? We have to be strong and protect Leomi.
You are right.
We cannot go around worrying about what the judge is going to decide. We just have to keep living.
Yes, and we are doing that, aren't we?
So what's your problem then?
Nothing. Nothing. I will remember not to talk anymore. We will be fine. I'm sorry I angered you, bebe. Please cool your temper and rest. And please, let's not talk about it over the phone. You know what Boubacar said about the government listening.
Jende went to bed that night, bitter, in spite of Nenny's apologies. Angry at her for recklessly exposing their child to harmful untruths, and angrier at himself for all the failures of his life. He made Leomi sleep alone in his cot that night, wanting nothing of cuddling with a child he might one day disappoint. But the next morning, when he awoke, Leomi was at his side, his small hands on his father's belly. Jende looked at the round, sweat-covered face and knew he had no choice but to snuggle close to his child and enjoy the rest of their father and son summer. That evening, they attended a classical music concert in St. Nicholas Park and listened as a blind pianist performed a piece so sorrowful it briefly clouded Jende's eyes. The next afternoon, eager to experience more of what a New York City summer had to offer those unable or unwilling to leave the city, he ditched the money he could be making in the Bronx and took his son for a swim at the public pool in East Harlem.
Papa, show me how you and Uncle Winston used to swim at Down Beach,
Leomi said, and Jende did, flaunting the backstroke he and his cousin used to do in the waters behind the botanic garden. After completing two laps while a giggling Leomi watched, Jende lifted the boy and positioned his back against the water to teach him the strokes. Watching Leomi laughing and flapping his arms in the water, Jende saw, for perhaps the first time, his son not only as a child, but also as a man in the making, a young man watching and learning from his father, a boy who wanted to follow in the footsteps of his papa and become a man like him in disposition, if not in possessions. That night, they slept together as usual, Leomi's arm around his father, and his head on Jende's chest. Never much of a praying man, Jende said a lengthy prayer for his boy as they lay, that Leomi would live a long, happy life. Chapter 21 Halfway into her stay in Southampton, Vince Edwards walked into his bedroom, jumped on his newly made bed while she was fluffing his pillows, and asked her to take a guess.
"Guess about what?"
she asked.
"Today's the day,"
he said, beaming.
"Day for the day I tell them."
Nenny looked confusedly at the face exploding with joy.
"Tell who? What?"
she asked, wondering why Vince assumed she had to know his news.
"Jende didn't tell you?"
"Jende didn't tell me what?"
"Never mind,"
he said, standing up and walking out of the room. Hours later, around 5 in the evening, Vince and Cindy left to meet Clark for dinner at a restaurant in Montauk. The next morning, Nenny saw nothing of Vince and very little of Cindy, who declined her breakfast and lunch and spent much of the afternoon on her phone, begging someone to please be reasonable and think about the consequences of his or her actions. When Nenny called Jende later that evening to ask what he thought might be going on, Jende asked her to please stay out of other people's business.
"If you know something, why won't you tell me?" she asked.
"If I tell you, what will you do with the information besides gossip about it with your friends?"
She hung up, determined to find out the story for herself. She couldn't eavesdrop any further on Cindy, who had left the house to go for an evening walk on the beach, and Mighty could only tell her that his parents and Vince were fighting. His mom wasn't telling him why, and Vince was back in the city. When Mighty had called Vince to ask why their mom was so upset, Vince had told him they would talk about it as soon as Mighty returned to the city, since it was hard explaining certain things over the phone. Two nights later, though, Nenny wouldn't have to wonder anymore. After making Mighty sautéed salmon and oven fries for dinner, plus Puff Puff, which Mighty had asked for after she told him it was what she and her siblings ate in the mornings as they walked to school, playing video games with him and tucking him in bed, she went to her bedroom to read a chapter in the textbook for the social psychology class she'd signed up for in the fall semester. Engrossed in a chapter on persuasion, she initially didn't notice the voices escalating in the kitchen. It was only after perhaps 3 minutes, after the beseechings and accusations appeared to have reached a crescendo, that she realized it was Mr. and Mrs. Edwards shouting in the kitchen after returning home from a wedding. She got out of bed, tiptoed up the basement stairs, and leaned on the door with her ear pressed against it.
"No," she heard Clark shout. "You can go back to her and work on your long list of issues if you must, but I'm not going anywhere."
"You'd rather see your family fall apart?"
Cindy shouted back, her voice trembling.
"You'd rather that than see a therapist and admit you've got problems that are destroying your family?"
"Yeah, let's focus on my problems because you don't have any."
"I'm not the reason our son is moving to India,"
Cindy cried.
"You think Vince is moving to India because of me?"
"He's moving to India because he's unhappy, Clark. He's miserable."
"Because of me?"
"Because we haven't succeeded in giving him a happy life. Because all he wants is to feel happy in his own family, and we can't even give him that. Can't you see?"
"Bullshit."
"Bullshit to what?"
"Bullshit to all your crap about feeling responsible for Vince's happiness,"
Clark shouted, amid the sound of the refrigerator door opening and slamming hard.
He's a grown man. He's responsible for his own happiness. I can't help it if he wants to be an idiot and throw away a perfectly good life. I can't do anything about it.
For many seconds, they were silent. Nanny closed her eyes and shook her head, unsure which of them to feel more sorry for. She imagined Clark was angrily drinking wine or beer straight from the bottle, while Cindy was silently weeping.
"Do you care?"
she heard Cindy say, her trembling voice now lower but sadder.
"Do you give a shit about how badly you're hurting us?"
"Right, sure. Working hard to give my family this life. How awful of me. Doing everything to make sure..."
"You're not doing everything. You've never done everything.
Until you understand that family must always come first, there are times when careers must take priority. There has never been a time when this marriage took priority for you. There's never been a time when this family took priority for you, not once.
That's why you're afraid of us going back to therapy. You don't want to see how selfish and callous you are."
"What do you want from me, Cindy?"
Clark shouted so loud, Nanny thought the walls vibrated.
"Tell me what you want from me."
"I want..."
Cindy wept.
"I want you. I want us. I want the boys to be happy, Clark. That's all I want. For us to be... for my family to be..."
Nanny heard footsteps walking away, and she could tell it was Clark Edwards, leaving his wife to cry alone in the kitchen. She heard a thump and a wail, and pictured Cindy slipping from against the counter to the floor. She imagined her sitting alone, crying on the cold kitchen floor. Nanny pulled her head away from the door and leaned against the railing. Should she do something? Would it be appropriate? What could she do besides go to the kitchen and see how she could help Cindy? She opened the door gently and silently stepped into the kitchen, afraid of startling Cindy, who was sitting where Nanny imagined she would be sitting. She was moaning softly with her head bowed, so lost in her misery that she didn't notice Nanny walking toward her. Only when Nanny stooped close to her did she lift her red, tear-stained face, look Nanny in her eyes, and begin weeping again.
"I'm sorry, madame,"
Nanny whispered.
I only want to see what I can do to make you feel better."
Cindy, with her head bowed again, nodded and sniffled. Nanny stood up, her hand supporting her belly, and grabbed the box of tissues on the kitchen island. She sat down next to Cindy and offered her a tissue, which Cindy took, blew her nose with, and began crying in.
"I hope you and Mr. Edwards are going to solve everything soon, madame. He thinks he has the right,"
Cindy whimpered, slightly above a whisper.
"Everyone, they all think they've got the right to treat me as they wish."
Nanny nodded, struggling to ignore the smell of alcohol spilling out of Cindy's mouth alongside her words. Her throat sounded parched, and her words stumbled in a slur, evidence to Nanny that the madame had drunk more glasses of wine than she could handle.
"Can I get you some water, madame?"
Nanny asked. Cindy shook her head and asked for a glass of wine, which Nanny quickly got and returned to her position on the floor. The madame took a sip, crying as she swallowed.
"Every single person, they believe they can treat me however, anyhow."
Nanny nodded again, the box of tissues in her hands.
"First, it was my father. He thought he had the right, you know,"
Cindy said.
"Drag my mother into that abandoned house. Force her. Do it to her by force. Don't give a shit about
not care for a second about what would happen to the child. She sniffled, took another sip of the wine, and wept.
And the government, our government,
she moaned, slurring, tears running down her cheeks, snot running down her nose.
They had the right to force my mother to carry the child of a stranger. Force her to give birth to the child because I don't know why.
Nenny's throat tightened at the sight of the devastated woman in pearls. Confused, though, as she was about which child Cindy was talking about.
I hated her, but can you blame her? She thought she had the right to. It was her right to beat me and curse at me and call me fat. Because every time she looked at me, she was reminded. I was a reminder of what he'd done to her. But why? What did I do? It's never the child's fault. Never the fault of an innocent.
Nenny looked away as Cindy picked up the wine glass from the floor and took a long sip. The realization of who the child was had come on so suddenly that her eyebrows had risen and her eyes had widened, and she'd had to restrain herself from cupping her mouth. She kept her face turned away, hoping Cindy hadn't seen the look on it, and not wanting to stare too hard at the wet, pitiful mess the madame had become. What was she supposed to say to Cindy now? She couldn't give her a hug to express what she wanted to say without words. So she had to say something. But what could she say to a drunken confession about the unbearable yoke of a life conceived in violence? What could she say about things she'd never pondered?
And now, Clark has the right to,
Cindy went on, looking blankly ahead as her voice quivered.
He's got every single right to love me far less than he loves his work. He's got every right to toss me aside, pick me up when it suits him. And Vince.
She pulled out another tissue, pressed her face into it, and began bawling hysterically.
Now Vince, too. He thinks he's got every right to abandon me, even though I've been a perfectly good mother. Even though I never abandoned my mother, even after all those years of...
Her shoulders shook, and Nanny, uncertain still of the best thing to do, put the tissue box on the floor and warily moved a hand to Cindy's right shoulder and began rubbing it. Cindy's cries grew louder as Nanny rubbed gently, simultaneously thinking about what else she could do to help the madame. She had to call someone to come over as soon as possible. But who? Not Clark. Not Vince. Maybe Cherie or June? Their numbers were on the refrigerator. But what would she give as a reason for calling at midnight? Tell them that a highly intoxicated Cindy couldn't stop crying? Tell them she didn't know what to say or do to make Cindy feel better?
I am so sorry, madame,
Nanny whispered.
I am so sorry for what your father did.
Cindy continued crying, her shoulders quaking in accordance with her sounds.
Did the police catch him, madame?
Cindy shook her head.
Maybe you could search for him, madame. Maybe if... I walk down the street. Every day I'm looking. Looking at any man who looks like me. I'm wondering, could that be him? My mother told me I must have his hideous face because I don't look anything like her. I walk around with this face, the face of a monster. And no one knows. No one knows how much it hurts. Vince has no idea how much it hurts. I am sorry about Vince, too, madame,
Nanny said. Cindy picked up her glass of wine and gulped down the remainder.
Nanny continued rubbing her shoulder as they sat in silence. The only noise in the kitchen, the sound of high-end electrical appliances. The kitchen floor had grown warm underneath them.
I don't want him to move to India, Cindy said, a firmness slowly appearing in her voice. But supporting him, that's not what's so hard for me to do. I can muster the strength to support my child even if it's not what I want. But his hurtfulness to me, how he thinks he's suddenly so righteous because he's found spirituality, that's what hurts me the most. I said to him, if what you care about is people, changing the world, what about getting a job at the Lehman Brothers Foundation? Clark could help him do that. But, oh no, what a ridiculous idea. He asked me, do I really think the goal of the Lehman Foundation is to make the world a better place? Do I know what Lehman Brothers does? Do I care about how corporations are destroying the world? I've tried to understand this anger. I can't. What does he have against being wealthy? Why should good, hard-working people feel bad about their money just because other people don't have as much money? Once, we were friends. My son and I, we were good friends. He found the truth, and now I am naive. Close-minded, materialistic, lost. The only way I can see the light is to first lose my ego.
Cindy sighed and tilted her head as if trying to stretch out an intolerable pain in her neck.
I told him, fine, go. Go search for this truth and oneness. I want you to be happy. But instead of going all the way to India, what about a retreat center somewhere in America? Maybe some place I heard about in New Mexico. Surely the truth has to be present in America, too. Maybe go to a grad school somewhere near a retreat center. I can't bear the thought of him being so far away. If anything happened to him, it would kill me.
Chapter 22. She returned from the Hamptons with far more designer clothes than she'd ever imagined having. Shoes and accessories, too. Cindy had told her to take as much as she wanted from the storage space in the attic, because whatever she didn't take was going to charity. So Nanny had cheerfully obliged, taking an old Louis Vuitton carry-on suitcase with a broken zipper, jam-packing it like roasted peanuts in a liquor bottle, and tying it shut with one of her blouses. Walking through Penn Station and the streets of Harlem, she had needed to stop at least a dozen times to rest from the weight of the Louis Vuitton on her right shoulder, the big brown paper bag full of Leomi's clothes and toys on her left shoulder, her rolling luggage in one hand, and more clothes and toys for Leomi in the other.
"Did you have to suffer like that just for some free clothes?"
Jende asked later that night, laughing after she told him how difficult it had been managing all the bags while the baby kicked nonstop.
"What do you mean, just for some free clothes?" she said. "This is not just any free clothes, Bebe. You know how much these things cost?"
Jende laughed her off, saying he didn't care.
Clothes were clothes, he said, no matter how much they cost or whose name was printed on them.
But Betty did not laugh her off. Betty understood that there was an undeniable difference between the styles and auras of Gucci and Tommy Hilfiger. Unlike Jende, she knew that all labeled clothes were not created equal, even if they were made from the same fabric by the same machine.
"You walk down the street wearing this Valentino blouse,"
Betty exclaimed, looking at the label of a white silk blouse when she visited days after Nanny's return.
"Can you imagine?" Nanny said.
"But you can't wear this just to walk down the street."
"Never in this lifetime. Something like this. I don't even know where I'll wear it to. Maybe a wedding? Or maybe I'll save it and they'll bury me in it when I die."
"Then let me wear it for you now, eh?"
Betty said, laughing and placing the blouse against her chest.
"I'll rock it with a leather skirt and high heel boots and then bring it back as soon as I hear you're dead so you can...
I beg. Give me back my blouse, crazy woman,
Nenny said, laughing and grabbing the blouse from Betty's hands. She stood in front of the full-length mirror on the bedroom door, put the blouse against her chest, and felt its fine silk and delicate buttons.
That woman must have really liked you, eh?
Betty said.
Like me why?
To give you all these things.
Nenny shrugged and knelt down next to the Louis Vuitton suitcase to repack the things they'd taken out to admire.
She didn't like me nothing, she said as she refolded the dresses and blouses. I did what she wanted me to do. She paid me with money and clothes.
But still,
it's not like she's ever going to wear them. You should have seen her closets. I never knew anyone can have that many clothes and shoes in one house. I would have taken one or two pairs of shoes.
No, you wouldn't, Nenny retorted, scoffing at Betty's bluff.
Yes, I would,
Betty insisted, widening her eyes and laughing.
Maybe some Calvin Klein and DKNY jeans, too. If I can force this mountain buttock into it. How would she know she lost it if she has so many things?
She wouldn't ever know. How can anyone know if one of their 50 pairs of shoes gets lost? And I'm not just saying 50. I swear to you, Betty, I stood in the shoe closet and counted 50. Plus another 50 or 100 in our apartment in Manhattan.
I'm sure.
And she's still so unhappy,
Betty said with a sigh.
Money truly is nothing.
She has her own kind of suffering that we can never understand,
Nenny said, rising from the floor to sit next to Betty on the bed.
And she's trying her best to cover it, which is not easy.
Your father was a rapist. You don't know his name. You don't know his face. What kind of money is going to help you with that kind of problem? You don't even know if he's black or white or Spanish.
Ah, Betty, don't take it too far. Her father has to be a white man.
You're saying that because you know the man?
The woman is a white woman.
That's what you think, eh? I can take you to the internet right now and show you on Google. All these white people, they all thought they were white. And then one day, they find out that someone was black. Their father, their grandfather, whatever.
I don't think something like that is what's going to bother her the most.
But it would bother me. If I find out one day that I'm not 100% black.
Betty turned her lips downward, shook her head, and Nenny laughed.
You don't ever have to worry about that, Nenny said.
With your charcoal skin and mountain buttocks, there's no way there can be anything inside you except African blood.
Jealousy is going to kill you,
Betty shot back, laughing as she leaned sideways and tapped her buttocks to emphasize the beauty of their size.
But seriously, she said, I don't know what I would do if my father...
I don't know what I would do too.
I would be afraid that I'm a curse, because it's a curse, right? You are a bastard, and on top of that, everyone knows your father was some rapist.
Kai! No wonder the woman drinks! Did you see her looking like that again?
Like that, eh? No. Thank Papa God.
But I saw an empty medicine bottle in the guest bathroom garbage. Same one like the one from that day.
It was for painkillers, right?
Nenny shrugged.
I don't know.
It had to be for painkillers. I was reading about it in my pharmacology class.
Now that you've taken one little pharmacology class, you think you know everything about drugs. Why don't you just go ahead and open a pharmacy?
Don't be hating, girl,
Betty said in her fake American accent.
You can take the class when you are ready. But I swear, it must have been something like that. Some kind of painkiller.
Because why?
What do you mean, because why? Aren't you the one who told me what she looked like when you found her with the medicine and the wine? I've taken painkillers. I know how those things can...
No, Nenny said, shaking her head. I was thinking that too, that maybe it was bad drugs, but...
But what?
But what if she was sick?
Sick of what? If she was only sick, why was she begging you not to tell anyone?
I don't know. The whole thing about that woman just confuses me.
Then why are you arguing with me? I can show you the chapter in my textbook. She's taking the painkiller, then adding the wine. These women, they start taking the pills for some pain in their body, and then it makes them feel good, so they take more, and then more.
But I've taken Tylenol,
Nenny said with a laugh,
and I didn't feel anything special.
Tylenol is not the same kind of thing, you countrywoman,
Betty said, laughing too, and then instantly developing a somber tone.
I'm talking about prescription painkillers for some really bad pain. The kind I had when... They gave me some last year at Roosevelt. Vicodin. And that was the name on the bottle. Vicodin. Wait, I'm not sure if it was. It must have been,
Betty said, standing up to fold the Burberry scarf and Ralph Lauren maxi dress Nenny had given her from Cindy's things.
I felt better every time I took it, even with everything I was feeling.
But you wouldn't have eaten it like candy, the way it looks like Mrs. Edwards is swallowing them.
Is that what you think? Don't be so sure. The hospital only let me have a 10-day supply. But if I had a way, I would have gotten more, maybe for another week. That thing made me feel so much better. But this country, doctors are too afraid of addiction. Mrs. Edwards, she must know someone who is giving it to her. Maybe a friend who is a doctor or a pharmacist. Or sometimes they buy it from other people. I just wonder how many she is taking a day.
Chapter 23. Every time Clark was in the car, morning, afternoon, evening, he was shouting at someone, arguing about something, giving orders on what had to be done as soon as possible. He seemed angry, frustrated, confused, resigned. This place is a mess, Leah told Jende whenever they were on the phone. He's going crazy. He's yelling at me and making me crazy. They're all going crazy. I swear, it's like some kind of crazy shit is eating everyone up. Jende told her he was truly sorry to hear how bad it was for her, and assured her repeatedly that he knew nothing more than what she already knew from the memos Tom was sending to Lehman employees. Memos in which he told them that the company was going through a bit of a tough stretch, but they should be back on top in no time. Leah's circumstances saddened Jende. The fact that she was clinging to a job that made her miserable because she was still 5 years away from receiving Social Security. It bothered him that she couldn't quit her job even though her blood pressure was rising and her hair was falling out, and she was getting only 3 hours of sleep a night. But it wasn't his place to tell her anything about what Clark was saying or doing. He couldn't tell her that Clark was sometimes sleeping in the office or going to the Chelsea Hotel some evenings for appointments that often lasted no more than an hour. He couldn't tell her that after these appointments, he usually drove the boss back to the office, where Clark probably continued working for more hours, his stress having been eased. His duty, he always reminded himself, was to protect Clark, not Leah.
Where are we going to, sir?
Jende asked on the last Thursday of August, holding the car door open in front of the Chelsea Hotel. Clark's appointment that day had lasted exactly an hour, but he had returned to the car still seeming weary, his face tightly bound by perpetual exhaustion. It was as if his appointment had been only half effective.
Hudson River Park, Clark said.
Hudson River Park, sir?
Jende asked, surprised the answer wasn't the office.
Yes. Anywhere in the park, sir. Go close to 11th and 10th, or somewhere near the piers.
Yes, sir.
Jende dropped Clark off at the end of Christopher Street and watched as he crossed the Westside Highway to the pier, his already slender shoulders sagging under the weight of the heat and the sun.
Where are you? He called to ask Jende 10 minutes later.
Around the same area, sir,
Jende replied.
I backed up into a good spot that opened up behind me.
Listen, why don't you come join me?
There's no need for you to sit in the car.
At the piazza?
Yes. I'm sitting all the way at the front. Come and meet me here.
Gende locked up the car and dashed across the highway toward the pier, where Clark was sitting on a bench, his jacket off, his face turned toward the sky. When Gende got to the bench, he realized Clark's eyes were closed. He seemed to be finding respite in the bountiful breeze blowing toward them. For the first time in months, he looked relaxed as the wind tousled his hair and wiped his brow. Gende looked up at the empty sky, which bore no resemblance to the thick air below. In a couple of days, August would be over, and yet the humidity was still dense, though it felt good to him. The sultriness mingled with the wind blowing over the Atlantic-bound river. On the bench, Clark breathed in and out, and in and out, again and again, for 5 minutes. Gende stood next to him and waited, careful not to move and disturb him.
"You're here,"
Clark said when he finally opened his eyes.
"Have a seat."
Gende sat down beside him, took off his jacket too.
"Beautiful, huh?"
Clark said as they watched the Hudson. "Nowhere as long, but every inch as purposeful and assured as the Nile and the Niger and the Limpopo and the Zambezi." Gende nodded, though confused as to why he was there, sitting on a bench at a pier, gazing at a river with his boss.
"It is very nice, sir."
"Thought you might enjoy it, instead of just waiting on the street."
"Thank you, sir. I am enjoying the fresh breeze. I did not even know there was a place like this in New York. It's a great park. If I could, I'd come here more often to watch the sunset."
"You watch sunsets, huh?"
"Nothing relaxes me more."
Gende nodded and said nothing, though he thought about how funny it was that both Clark and Vince loved sunsets. The only people he'd ever met who went out of their way to sit by a body of water and stare at the horizon. He wondered if Vince knew this about his father, and what difference it would make if he didn't know and then discovered it by chance. How differently Vince would feel about his father if he realized that they shared a great love for something only a sliver of humans make a deliberate effort to see. For a few minutes, the men sat in silence, watching the river flowing leisurely, in no rush for its meeting with the ocean.
"I'm sure you know by now that Vince will be moving to India in 2 weeks,"
Clark said.
"No, sir. I did not know. India?"
Clark nodded.
"No more law school for him. He wants to wander the earth."
"He is a good boy, sir. He will come back safely to America when he is ready."
"Or he may not for a long time."
"That's fine. I'm not the first father to have a son who defied him and decided he wanted to live his life in an unorthodox manner."
"I hope you are not too angry with him, sir."
"Actually, Cindy thinks I'm not angry enough, and that makes her angry. Like somehow I'm giving up on him because I don't love him enough. But the thing is, I almost admire him."
"He is not afraid?"
"No, and there's something to be said for that. At his age, all I wanted was the life that I have right now. This exact life. This was what I wanted."
"It is a good life, sir. A very good life."
"Sometimes. But I can understand why Vince doesn't want it. Because these days, I don't want it either. All this shit going on at Lehman. All this stuff we would never have done 20 years ago because we stood for something more. And now, really dirty shit is becoming the norm. All over the street. But try to show good sense. Talk of consequences, have a far long-term outlook, and they look at you as if you've lost your marbles."
Gende nodded.
"And I know Vince has got a point, but the problem is not some system. It is us, each of us. We've got to fix ourselves before we can fix a whole damn country. That's not happening on the street. It's not happening in Washington.
It's not happening anywhere. It's not like what I'm saying is new, but it's only getting worse. And one man or two men or three men cannot fix it.
No, sir.
But everything I have, I worked hard for, and I'm proud of. And I'll fight to the end to preserve it. Because when this life's good, it's very good. And the price I pay, that's just part of it.
Very true, sir,
Jende said, nodding. When you become a husband and father, you pay a lot of prices. It's more than your duty as a husband and father. It's your duty to your parents, too, your siblings. When I went to Stanford, I was going to study physics, become a professor like my dad. Then I saw what was possible on a professor's salary and what was possible on an investment banker's salary, and I chose this path. I'm not going to sit here and be one of those self-righteous assholes, because my original reason for choosing this career was never noble. I can't say I didn't fantasize about the sports car and private jets, but it's different now. Now it means the world to me how well I'm taking care of my family. No matter how bad it gets at work, I know that at the end of the day, I can send my parents on vacations to see the world, pay for every medical bill that comes up, make sure my sister doesn't suffer because her husband's dead, make sure my wife and sons have far more than what they need. That's what Vince doesn't understand. That you don't only do what makes you happy. You think about your parents, too. Vince doesn't see this side of you, sir. He sees a father who works at a bank and makes money, but I tell him, I say, your parents have other sides you do not see because you are their child. It is only now that I am old that I look at some things that my father did, and I understand. I told him, I said, I'm not asking you to stay in law school and become a lawyer so you can be like me. I'm asking you because I know what it takes to be successful in this country. You've got to separate yourself from the pack with a good education, a good paying career. I read about folks who thought it was all fun and games when they were younger, and look at them now, barely getting by. Because unless you make a certain kind of money in this country, life can be brutal. And I don't ever want that for him, you know? I don't ever want that for my son. Jende nodded, looking afar. For several minutes the men were silent, just as the sun was one-third of the way below the low-rises of New Jersey. They watched as it went down ever so slowly, bidding them adieu, bidding the city adieu, until it rose again from behind the East River to bring a new day with its promises and heartbreaks. Wow, Jende said, mesmerized by what he'd just witnessed. I know the sun comes up and goes down, but I never knew that it does it so nicely. Amazing, isn't it?
Sir, Jende said after a brief silence, I think Vince will stay in India for a few months and run back to law school.
I won't be surprised, Clark said with a laugh. I don't know how India is, Mr. Edwards, but if there is heat and mosquitoes there like we have in Cameroon, I will be picking him up at the airport before New Year. The men laughed together. I will not worry about Vince for 1 minute, sir. Even if he stays, he will be happy. Look at me, sir. I am in another country, and I am happy. That's one way of looking at it. A man can find a home anywhere, sir.
Funny. As I was thinking about Vince today, I wrote a poem about leaving home.
You write poems, sir?
Yeah, but I'm no Shakespeare or Frost.
Jende scratched his head.
I'm sorry, sir, he said. I have heard a little about Shakespeare, but I don't know the other man. I did not make it that fine school. They were both great poets. I'm just saying my poetry is pretty remedial, but it keeps me going on many days.
Jende nodded, and he could see that Clark could tell he didn't quite understand the last point either.
You learn how to write poems in school, sir?
he asked. No. Actually, I just started a few years ago. A colleague gave me this little book of poetry, which I thought was a rather odd gift. Why would anyone think I could use a book of poetry? Maybe it was just one of those lazy gifts where people pull stuff off the shelves. A Christmas gift, sir? Yeah. Anyway, I kept it on my desk, picked it up one day, and loved the poem so much that I decided to try writing one. Feels real good to just write out lines about whatever you're feeling. You should try it sometime. It sounds very good, sir. I wrote one for Cindy, but she didn't like it much. So I just write for myself now. I will be glad to read one, sir. Really? I can show you. Damn it, Clark said, looking at his watch. Didn't realize it was getting this late.
Oh, I'm so sorry, sir. I should have kept my eyes open. I was just talking and talking without paying any attention to the time.
No, no. I'm glad we talked. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. I hope I didn't put you in an awkward position, throwing out my feelings about work and shit.
No, sir. Please, Mr. Edwards, thank you so much for inviting me here.
Well, thank you for listening, Clark said, smiling. And I'll be glad to recite the poem to you. It's called Home. And if you don't like it, I'd rather you don't say anything.
Yes, sir,
Jende said, smiling too.
I will not say anything whatsoever.
Okay, here goes. Home will never go away. Home will be here when you come back. You may go to bring back fortune. You may go to escape misfortune. You may even go just because you want to go. But when you come back, we hope you'll come back. Home will still be here.
Chapter 24. The one thing she missed about the Hamptons, besides the boys, Mighty especially, was the food. The scrumptious, catered food served at the Edwards' cocktail parties. All her life she'd thought Cameroonians had the best food, but apparently she was wrong. Rich American people knew something about good food, too. Despite having to work 15 hours on the days when Cindy hosted the parties around the pool, she looked forward to them because the food was too good, so ridiculously good that she had called Fatou one evening and told her she was sure she'd died and gone to food heaven, to which Fatou had replied, "How you gonna be sure the cook no piss inside food to make it good?" Nanny was sure the cook hadn't done anything to the food, since the three chefs Cindy always hired for the parties prepared most of it in the kitchen, and their three servers, with her assistance, took it directly from the kitchen to the backyard. All kinds of foods were there, things she'd seen in magazines and wished she could taste just by looking at the perfectly lighted pictures. Wickedly delectable creations like sesame-seared tuna with lemon wasabi vinaigrette, beef tenderloin and olives on garlic crostini with horseradish sauce, California caviar and chives on Melba toast, mushroom caps stuffed with jumbo lump crab meat, steak tartare with ginger and shallot, which she loved the most and devoured without restraint, though she'd never once imagined she'd one day find herself eating raw meat like a beast in the forest. She was certain she'd gotten her fill, thanks to the ample leftovers at the end of all three parties, but she was nonetheless glad when Anna called and asked if she could come help out at a brunch Cindy and her friends were having in Manhattan.
"Are they going to use the same chefs from the Hamptons?" she asked Anna.
"No," Anna said. "This one is just brunch. Two chefs from here and no servers. So me and you, we going to serve and clean after. The other girl who works for Cindy's friend used to work with me every year, but she quit last week, so Cindy tell me to call you."
"All those people for just the two of us to serve and clean after?"
"No worry. Not too many people. Just her and the five friends and their husbands and some children. Cindy says $100 for you, only 3 hours. It's fair, no?"
Nanny agreed it was beyond fair, and arrived at June's apartment on West End Avenue the next Sunday afternoon.
There were no more than 6 children there, and Mighty, thankfully, was one of them. He ran to her when he saw her entering the apartment and hugged her so tightly that Nenny had to remind him he wasn't her only baby. She had a